want to do background reading, you should. The best place is Feynman and Hibbs's book, up to about chapter 3.1, up to and including chapter 3.1. Also, while I remember, there's a typo corrected, I can't promise typo free, but it, certainly several typos corrected version of these, the notes I gave out last time, the introductory notes, which is or should soon be up on the SciWiki. It's on the wiki. Great. Okay, thanks, Sarah. Okay. We got into quite an interesting discussion last time, both about mathematical rigor and about conceptual rigor. And I just wanted to preface this lecture with a few comments that I guess will apply to quite a lot of the course. The level of mathematical rigor, but I'm not ashamed to admit it, but let me be open about it now, especially in our discussion of the continuum, when we're talking about wave functions on the real line or in R3, infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, operators, which may have unbounded eigenvalues, may have continuous spectra, unnormalizable states like the things we talked about last time, the X and P, and in spades, I guess, the discussion of path integrals, our level of rigor is going to be mathematical rigor is going to be low. We're trying here to introduce ideas and to explore ideas and not to justify everything from first principles. And it's worth remembering, I mean, this isn't supposed to be a reason for universal sloppiness. Nobody gets a free pass on that. But it's worth keeping in mind that we're setting things up for future courses, which are going to discuss quantum field theories. And the sad truth is that ultimately we simply do not have a completely mathematical rigorous definition or a treatment of the calculations of any but trivial relativistic quantum field theories. So free field theories, indeed, you can say rigorous things about. But free field theories are very boring, of course. You fire stuff in, you fire other stuff in, they just propagate without doing anything. As soon as we get to talk about interactions, essentially we have to leave rigor behind, at least, and certainly when we talk about the physically relevant interactions. So it's many points in modern physics. We don't have any choice except to explore ideas which are not completely rigorously justifiable from first principles and techniques that evolve again, non-rigorous jumps, but nonetheless give us very powerful insights, very powerful results. And we do that because they work, and we have to hope that one way or another they'll eventually be rigorized. That said, sometimes in this course, we're going to skate over things that already have been rigorized, but we're not going to rigorize them. So, for instance, the discussions of X and P really goes back to Schwarz's work in the 1950s. There is a perfectly rigorous treatment of these things, but I'm not going to get into it in this course. And just as important is the question of conceptual rigor. And again, several of you were asking very good, very probing questions about this last time. And again, cards on the table. The presentation of quantum theory that we've had so far, in particular, the presentation I gave you of the measurement postulate is, I've said arguably just to, in case there are any diehard Copenhagenites out there who'll be offended, but is, I would say, clearly imprecise. What exactly is a measurement? We have a measurement postulate, but we don't have a mathematical definition of measurement. Where and exactly when is this measurement thing happening? It's sort of clear if we think about it physically that a measurement must be at least slightly extended in both in space and in time, and yet the measurement postulate talks about instantaneous changes. So our presentation is imprecise and, truth be told, a little bit old-fashioned, at least a minute. We're going to say more about measurement towards the end of the course. We're going to take another look at it and at least introduce some modern ideas in modern treatments of measurement. Again here, though, I don't want to, far be it for me to argue for conceptual sloppiness. But we have to keep in mind the realities. And to my mind, at least, the reality is that there is no way of presenting quantum theory from axioms that is generally accepted as conceptually problem-free. You'll find people who have their favorite view and will argue strongly that it solves all the problems. And these include some very thoughtful and brilliant people. But you'll find that there's absolutely no general consensus in the physics community. For every apparently powerful argument for one way of presenting quantum theory, you'll find also apparently powerful counter-arguments and equally thoughtful people on the other side. So we just have to accept science in the state that it currently is. One doesn't want to forget these problems, but nor does one want to get stuck all the time in worrying about them. We need to understand everything that quantum theory can do, everything it can predict and explain. And that's a huge amount. It's the most astonishingly successful theory humanity's ever found, I think. And you need to keep both things in your mind. Quantum theory can predict and explain an awful lot, and yet it seems there still is work to be done on the foundations, and maybe even new science there. Maybe these foundational problems in the end are pointing towards some testable predictions that go beyond quantum theory. Who knows? I don't know, certainly. These topics will be covered in much more depth in the Quantum Foundations course, and some of the research programs in these directions will be. But I'll come back from time to time to make more comments. That slide has become unhappy for some reason. Okay. Let me just look ahead for a moment. Okay, let me draw this on the board. So, I want to keep thinking for a while more about the double slit experiment, and let's just focus. Let's assume that the slits are symmetrically arranged here, but I really want to focus on the other side of the slit. Yeah, so suppose we're looking here at the screen at some point. Like this, and I want to draw this diagram, sorry for my artistic imprecision, but so that these two distances from here to here and here to here are the same. So A, B, C. So there was a pre-quantum way of thinking about interferometry, which is still important, still when it comes down to it, the way people often sort of develop their intuitions about interferometry experiments, which is de Broglie's idea that whether we're talking about photons or electrons, what we now know are massless particles or massive particles, we can think of them as in some way wave-like, associated with waves. So this pre-quantum intuition of de Broglie's said qualitatively, okay, there's something wave-like, quantitatively, that we could say what the wavelength is, we'll come to that in a minute. And the idea here then is, so let's suppose, for the sake of the argument, these successive peaks of the wave The idea is we think that there's part of the wave going along like here, peaking, peak, 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 and part going like here. And if this extra distance is some integer multiple of the wavelength, then we get constructive interference. The waves are peaking together at the screen, and so we expect to see a bright spot. If it's half-odd integer, then we get destructive interference. The waves are out of sync, and the peak of one hits the trough of the other. So I'm... that isn't a very well-justified model. Of course, we know now that the right way to think about this is quantum theory. But it is a model that gives the correct predictions in interferometry experiments. And we want to try and understand why it gives the correct predictions. So let's take a step back from that and see where we can get. I want to go back to the Schrödinger equation, which we've been working with so far, and look for a kernel function. By the way, do we have a pointer? So I want to find an object K. We're going to start out allowing it to depend on two position variables, x prime x, t prime t. But in fact, in the cases we're interested in at the moment, it depends only on the separations between them. So x prime minus x, t prime minus t. And I want two things from k. First, that if I just look at the prime variables, x prime and t prime, it satisfies the Schrödinger equation in those prime variables. So that's equation one there. And second, that if I push t prime closer and closer to t from above, thanks very much, that it tends to the delta function in x and x prime. Why do we want such a beast? Because if we have such a thing, then it gives us straight away a general way of solving the Schrödinger equation. So the idea now is I start with psi of xt at some fixed time t, and I define psi prime of x prime t prime for any x prime and t prime greater than t to be the integral of k times psi d3x. So you notice we have this variable x dummy. Now, if you look at the property one of k, well, that tells us if I apply this operator on the left, I'm going to get the same thing as applying it inside the integral. The only prime variables are here. We're not integrating over them. And there's no prime there. So psi prime will be a solution to the Schrödinger equation. And if you look at property two, well, in the limit as t prime tends to t, k tends to the delta function. And so psi prime tends to the integral of the delta function times psi. In other words, it tends to psi. So psi prime satisfies the Schrödinger equation and it equals psi at time t. And so it is, and the Schrödinger equation is a first order differential equation in time. So it has a unique solution for t prime greater than t. So we've just constructed that solution, psi prime. OK, so we'd like to find a thing called thing k. Here, and yeah, please. They will, yeah. Yeah, actually, that's a good point, thank you. So feel free to write down everything I'm saying, but I will put it all up on the wiki after the lectures. Okay, so for the moment, I just want to pull out from pretty much thin air an expression for k. But look at it. You can check that this expression does have the properties we want. If I apply the Schrödinger equation, well, I have a d2 dx squared term, and that will pull down a p squared, and I have a d by dt term, and that will pull down the p squared. And if you check the factors, indeed, they cancel, so I get a p, basically p squared minus p squared. And so this Schrodinger operator kills k, as it should. If I look at the limit as t tends to 0, well, this term basically goes away, and now I just have the integral of e to the ipx over h bar. That is a delta function with a right normalization. So this thing in this form clearly is the kernel that we're looking for. And we could use our look again at this. This is, it looks a little complicated maybe, but it's just a Gaussian integral in three variables, and we could do them one by one, p1 squared, p2 squared, p3 squared, and there's a linear term there. So we already have Gaussian tricks for integrating anything of this form, and that's what we get. Okay, so we have a function of x and t with the right properties. And if you think about the definition of k, let me step back just for a moment. So we could construct general solutions for the Schrodinger equation from k. But look again, k itself is a solution. It's a solution with the singular initial condition that we start out with a delta function. If you start out with a delta function in x and propagate forward, k is what you get. So if we have something that's approximately a delta function, we can use k to work out how it evolves. And that, without worrying too much about the approximations that are going on here, that's how I want to reinterpret the double slit experiment now. So we have something that's tightly peaked coming from the source, propagates to here. The wall is effectively measuring what the particle here, with the result that we create a superposition of two more tightly peaked states created by the slits. And they propagate to x double prime. So we can use k for that step to that step, and that one to that one, and likewise that. This is just a shrunken version of the previous diagram. So up to some expression for this tightly peaked wave function and this constant, psi at the screen is going to be given by some sum of products of propagators. So from x to xa, this is the top thing, the top line, x to xa, and then xa to x double prime, that second one, summed with the two propagators in the lower path. Okay, but we already have an expression for k. So we can look at how it changes if we change the length of a path. And you see, it really does only depend on the length of a path. So I want to assume for the moment that we're interested in some particular time. The particle goes through the slits at time t prime, and we get a detection at t double prime. But we have different paths, particularly this one and this one, of different lengths. We have length squared in here, so we have a phase, e to the I times something. We have a phase that depends on the square length of the path. If I change x to x plus delta x, then I'll pick up a factor of 2 because I have a square here, and the phase changes by m over h bar times t minus t prime times x delta x. Another way of thinking of that is x is the distance that the particle is traveling along the path. T minus t prime is the time it's taken. So x over t minus t prime is just the momentum. So this is just p over h bar times the change of the path length. So turning that around, if I take delta x to be 2 pi times h bar over p, or since h bar is just h over 2 pi, I take delta x as h over p, I change this factor that multiplies I here by a total of 2 pi, and so I don't change the exponential at all. And that quantity h over p is nothing but the de Broglie wavelength. So we recover de Broglie's intuition and that calculation that was based on it there from within quantum mechanics, from within the Schrodinger equation. If the path lengths differ by integer multiples of the de Broglie wavelength, we're going to get constructive interference. Half on integer, we get destructive interference. Okay, I wanted, so these aren't formal problems. I just wanted to leave you with some other things you might want to think about to do with the double slit experiment. A couple of things. One is actually a famous discussion that goes back to the Bohr-Einstein debate. But if it's not familiar, it's very well worth thinking about. We tend to think when we sort of set up a double slit experiment as though the slit is firmly anchored to the table and the table's firmly anchored to the earth and the whole, there's just no freedom in the whole setup. It's entirely rigid. But we don't have to do things that way. We can set up some sort of movable slit that's sitting on little wheels here that are running on a track. And if you think about it, if a photon goes through this slit and bounces here, there is some momentum transfer going on here. So the photon's momentum is getting a little kick this way, and there must be some compensating kick that way. And similarly, if it goes through this slit, well, the kicks are going to be different. In fact, they're going to be in the potentially the opposite direction, certainly of different magnitude. So we have a, I won't say a paradox, but we have a complication, at least, in our discussion of the double slit experiment. It looks as though we could set things up like that, get our interferometry pattern, whatever it is, and look at the momentum of the wheeled slit before and afterwards, and try and understand which slit the particle went through from how that momentum changed. So the question you might want to think about is, could that work? Is there anything sort of physically wrong with that setup? And supposing it could, at least in principle, what would we actually see if we did do that? Would it change the interference pattern? Would it give us a way of both getting interference and working out which slit the particle went through? Or some sort of hybrid? It's a good thing to think about. Something else I've sort of glossed over a little bit, and again, you might want to contemplate for yourselves. I've sort of effectively said a couple of times, the particle comes from the source to the wall, and then we can think of the wall as basically detecting it. Maybe it's actually even set up so that it flashes when a particle hits it. And so we carry an effective measurement here, and if we don't measure the particle on the wall, then it's going, to use slightly classical language, through the two slits. In other words, we have an effective collapse of the wave function here. So that's certainly a possible way to set up the experiment, but it's a pretty unusual one. I'm not sure, in fact, it's ever been set up quite that way. Usually we don't do that. We have a wall that maybe absorbs the particles, maybe just allows them to reflect back in the direction of the source. So, I'd suggest it would be fruitful to think whether that makes any difference. If it doesn't, why not? How can we justify the analysis that we've given in the case where we have, for instance, particles reflecting from the wall? Okay, let's again take a further step back from the Schrodinger equation for the moment and think a little bit more abstractly about what we've been doing. We've got some quantum state, and it's been potentially a function of n position variables and of time t. We've got some differential operator that we write as h. But abstractly, we can just write this as some operator in Hilbert states, some time-dependent state in Hilbert space. And then we have a differential equation. This is ih bar d by dt, this thing. What do we know about this equation? Well, it's linear, for one thing. The differential equation is linear. Superposition principle in quantum mechanics tells us it should be linear, tells us this is a fundamental property of nature. But if I take two solutions, psi1, which evolves to psi1, there should be primes here, I'm sorry. Psi1 evolves to psi1 prime at t prime. Psi2 evolves to psi2 prime at t prime. Then any complex linear combination a1 psi1 plus a2 psi2 will evolve to a1 psi1 prime plus a2 psi2 prime. So we could think of that linear evolution as itself defined by some operator that depends in general on t and t prime. Sorry. Looking for chalk. Any eraser is under the screen? Ah, yeah, thank you. Okay, so here's T. Here's T prime. Solving the differential equation gives us some way of taking, some linear way of taking states at time t to states at time t prime. So there must be some linear operator. Let's call it u. It's a slightly pregnant notation there, but let's use it. U of t prime that moves solutions at time t to time solutions at time t prime. So we should be able to find physical solutions. We should be able to find normalized solutions. That tells us that psi prime of t prime has to have the same inner product with itself as psi of t. In particular, if they're both normalized to 1, then this inner product equals 1 whenever this one is. And so u dagger u equals the identity. But there's another thing we could do with this differential equation. We have d by dt I can just as easily evolve this backwards as forwards. So I must have another operator, u of t prime t, by exactly the same arguments. U of t prime is linear. And if I evolve forwards in time and then backwards in time, starting with a particular state psi, I must get back to psi. So this thing u dagger, that has the property that u dagger u is that entity, must be the same as u with the time coordinates reversed, tt prime. So we now have u, and I can go either way. I can go from t to t prime, u, and then u backwards. I can go from t prime to t, u backwards, and then u. Both ways around, I must get the identity. So this whole equation holds. And combine that with that, I have that u dagger is u dagger u is the identity. In other words, this thing u is, as I guess we expected from the notation, necessarily a unitary operator. And, well, we can evolve from t to t prime and then carry on evolving, evolve again to t double prime. So we get a natural composition law here. U of t double prime t is given by the product on the left. We also, that's an important qualification, if we're talking about time-independent dynamics, if v doesn't depend explicitly on time but only on the xi, then although u's written as though it depends on both time coordinates, the actual choice of the value of the initial time is irrelevant. I can solve the differential equation forward whatever the initial t is, and nothing in the mathematics depends on it. So we can actually simplify the notation. U of t prime t is just u of a function that depends only, an operator function that depends only on the difference, t prime minus t. Okay, so this seems like a useful thing to calculate. What do we know about it so far? We know that u is defined by this time evolution law. And so psi of t is just u of t psi of 0. So we have an equation here which holds for any initial state psi 0. And that gives us an operator equation, I h bar d by dt u is hu. Suppose for the moment these things that are actually operators were just ordinary functions of time. This would be a pretty trivial differential equation to solve. I could just write down u of t is e to the minus I ht over h bar. So let's play a formal trick for the moment. Let's just take the definition we already had for numbers and apply it to operators. So let's define exponential of any operator A to be given by the power series sum, whatever n factorial a to the n, and see what we can do with that. Well, that's at least going to make sense. It's at least going to give us a well-defined operator if whenever we apply this power series to a state psi, we're going to end up with a sum of states. So here's psi and here's a psi. Of course, really these are moving around in Hilbert space, but this is the best I can do to draw it. A squared psi. So for instance, if these things get smaller and smaller and smaller and converge to some point, and we could prove that's true for any state psi, then we have a definition of this thing, and maybe we can work with that. Okay, well, the case we're actually interested in is a particular case for the moment of the Hamiltonian H. And we know that's Hermitian. We know it has, therefore, has real eigenvalues. We know it has a complete orthonormal eigenbasis. And for the moment, I'm going to assume that we have a discrete spectrum, but actually, that's just to really simplify the notation. This works equally well for a continuous spectrum. So we could write H in terms of its eigenfunctions and eigenvectors, like so, sum lambda n, en, en. If I look at e to the minus I h t over h bar applied to an eigenfunction, well, since h en is lambda n en, the power series in h that defines the exponential will just give us a power series in lambda. So we have this equation. So if I take a general state psi, and it's normalized, I could write it as some linear combination of the eigenfunctions. Here's the normalization condition. And now I look at e to the minus iht over h bar psi. I'd use this equation. I just get this sum. Call that thing psi prime and look at the normalization of psi prime. Well, I have a mod an squared, and then I just get two cancelling terms, e to the minus I a lambda n and e to the plus lambda n, for each contribution. So indeed, psi prime is certainly well defined, but it's normalized. So everything actually works. We have a natural definition for the time evolution operator in terms of the exponential of the Hamiltonian. I'm not going to really do anything with these, but just for people who've never seen this before, you could play this game with other interesting power series, for instance, logarithm or 1 over 1 minus an operator. Okay, let's remember again this important caveat that we've been assuming that the potential, and so the Hamiltonian, has no explicit dependence on time. So then we have u of t is e to the minus I ht over h bar. If I take a small time interval t, let's say epsilon, I can write out the full power series, but I can if I'm just interested in the leading order terms, I can truncate it like so. And so we can work both ways. If I have a H, I can construct U. If I have a general expression for U, I can obtain H from the small epsilon limit, just as U minus 1 divided by the rest of this stuff in the limit as epsilon tends to 0. What else do we have? Well, obviously, if I don't evolve forward in time at all, I don't change the state, so U of 0 is the identity. Forward and backward, again, gives the identity. So U of minus t, which is the same thing we saw as U of t dagger, is just the inverse. So we have a well-defined inverse for all these u's. U of t plus t prime, well, we already agreed, move forward once, move forward again. That's the same thing as moving in one jump. And given, so we have closure, the product of these things is just another one. And given that, we obviously have associativity because it doesn't really matter which way I put the brackets here. It still gives me U of t plus t prime plus t double prime. So we've got all the conditions for a group. We have a one parameter group of unitary operators. The parameter t in principle can run from, well, for any finite value. And it's intimately connected with the Hamiltonian H. We're going to say the Hamiltonian H generates the exponential group elements. It's the thing that you apply the exponential to in order to make the group elements. Okay. So now let's think again a little bit more about the two-slit experiment and the interfering path amplitudes. If that works for two slits, it should work in a more complicated experiment in which I set up several walls, and each wall has not necessarily two, but perhaps several slits in it. I just need to look at all the ways that I get through from the start to the finish. So I've drawn a couple of paths here, but it's clear I could have drawn an awful lot more. I could go from the source to any slit in the first wall and then to any slit in the second, and so on. Well, that's a good question. Sorry, should I repeat the question? Yeah. So the question was, are we restricting attention to paths that go forwards in this direction as time increases, or are we also going to allow paths that go backwards? So, for instance, something like this, and then back here, and then round through here, and then forward. Well, in the two-slit experiment, well, I guess we did assume that there was some initial time, approximately defined at least, at which the particle left the source, some intermediate time at which it went through the slits, and then some final time at which it hit the screen. So for the moment, I want to work with that intuition. It's a great question, but for the moment, let's restrict attention to paths that in which x increases, x, the separation from the screen, in other words, decreases as time goes forward. Okay, we at least got that to work in the case of the two-slit experiment. So it should also work in the case of several slits and several walls. But now there's a standard sort of game we can play here. If it works for a wall with two and three and four slits, we can just carry on drilling slits. And we can approach some sort of Zen state in which we have a wall which is nothing but slits. All whole, no wall. And that suggests that we ought to be able to understand quantum amplitudes that we've already been looking at as arising from all piecewise linear paths. We can think as though there's a sort of virtual wall here that's actually all holes. And so we ought to be able to look at its propagation to here, any point in that wall, and similarly here, and so on. So unless we actually have physical walls here, we should be able to understand propagation from the source to the detector as a sum over all these paths. And still for the moment, I'm following the intuition from the two-slit experiment. So I'm going to assume that we have steady progress in this direction as time increases, but a variability in this direction. So I've drawn one out of a large infinite collection of paths there. Let's think about the one-dimensional Schrödinger equation and explore this intuition a little bit further. So we now know one way of thinking about the Schrödinger equation in terms of the time evolution operator generated by the Hamiltonian. Psi of t is u of t psi of 0. U of t is given by that exponential. Let's take h. In fact, we have to take h to have no explicit time dependence. So for a single particle, h of this form. I can divide the time into the relevant time interval, the time from here, the source, to here, the detection, into some large number n. So let's take total time to be t. T is n times delta. Delta gets small as n gets large. And I can look at the propagation from time 0 to time delta to time 2 delta, 3 delta, and so on, all the way up to n times delta. And I get a large infinite collection of possible different ways to propagate from x0 to xn. Okay, well, we now have a convenient way of writing this total time evolution that fits that discussion. U of t is a product of u of delta. Remember, u depends only on the time interval, and the time intervals are the same, so we just have n copies of u of delta in there. And we have different ways to resolve the identity. The identity is given by integrals over these position eigenstates or over the momentum eigenstates, which have these, I hope by now, familiar properties. So I'm free to introduce other ways of writing the identity in the middle here. Let's do that. I want to work with position resolution. So integral over x1, x1, dx1, and then another dummy variable x2, x2, dx2, and so on, all the way through. So the thing we're actually interested in is the propagator. Let me just emphasize that. The propagator from some point at the start here to some point at the end there for a given time t. And that's, once I've introduced these resolutions of that entity, we're really interested in just the propagation from some space coordinate, let's call it 0, to some general coordinate x. It's only going to depend on the difference anyway, so we might as well set the first one to 0. And likewise for time, we might as well set the initial time to 0 and the final one to t. So we now have an integral over all the discrete paths, piecewise linear paths over these little time intervals that takes this form. And we see here amplitudes like this, xn minus 1 u of delta xn minus 2, for instance. We've slightly broken the symmetry by calling the last point x and the first one 0. So a slightly nicer notation would be to write the first coordinate as x0 so that it's related to x1 in the same way as x1 is to x2, and the last one xn. Let's do that. So our idea now is to try and take the limit in which n tends to infinity and obtain an integral over all the paths, at least all of the forward moving paths from 0 to x. Okay, well, we're going to have to actually calculate these individual amplitudes. What do we have? We have that u is given by e to the minus ih times delta over h bar for an evolution of time delta. H is just p squared over 2m plus v of x. And for small delta, we can extract the linear term. And we're going to do a calculation in which the higher order terms in delta are going to end up being dropped. They're going to end up vanishing. So sort of having gone ahead and realized that's going to be the case, we're just going to write things as order delta squared and neglect them here. OK, so notice I can write this sum another way as 1 minus I delta over h bar p squared over m, 1 minus I delta v of x. And I get an order delta squared term, which is the product of those two things. But that just gets sucked up into my order delta squared here. And I can rewrite this again as an exponential. And I'm making an error in doing that, but it's an order delta squared error. And likewise, this one, order delta squared. So that still gets sucked up in there. So for the unwary, be clear here. This isn't a trivial identity in general. I have e to the minus I delta over h bar, sum operator A plus sum operator B. I've written it as e to the minus I delta over h bar operator A times e to the minus delta over h bar operator B. In general, that won't work. It's valid to order delta squared. But if we have general operators A and B, e to the A times e to the B, well, write out the power series, you get something like 1 plus A plus B, and then look at, for instance, the quadratic terms. I have A times B, and I have half A squared, half B squared. So with the factor of a half, I get a 2AB in there. Now look at this thing, e to the A plus B. Well, that's 1 plus A plus B plus a half. And now I have to take A plus B squared. So my quadratic term looks like this. And these things aren't in general equal. For them to be equal, I would have to have the A times B equals B times A. I'd have to have the operators commute. So this calculation is only legitimate because we're dropping the higher order terms here. And again, I know this is familiar to some of you, but probably not all. There's a general expression for products of exponentials of operators, which is consistent with what we just said. E to the A times e to the B will equal e to the A plus B if the operators commute. That term will vanish, and so will all these terms, which also turn out to depend on commutators of relevant operators. But in general, it's a rather complicated thing in the exponent. So we have to take care in manipulating these exponentials, but we're okay here. So we've managed to separate out the exponential into these two terms, and now we've got to deal with calculating this thing. And you'll notice this term just depends on x. So that's actually, that part of the calculation actually drops out straight away. V of x times xr, well, that's just the operator v of x acting on the state xr. That's just going to give me v of xr. So I can pull out that number. And the only remaining thing I have to worry about is the amplitude of the x states around the operator e to the p squared times constant factor. Well, I can always introduce another resolution of that entity. So since I have a p squared in there, let's introduce this one. The identity is the integral over pr times prpr, Kepler. And now I can evaluate the action of this thing on pr. E to the minus I pr squared delta over 2m h bar. So that comes out. I'm just left with a product of these two amplitudes. And that, well, we know what those amplitudes are. E to the minus IXR PR over H bar, sorry, XR plus 1. And the other way around, so minus XR PR over H bar. It's going to be convenient to think about this as to rewrite this in terms of the velocity. Along the path. So if we think we've jumped from XR to XR plus 1 in time delta, well, that's consistent with saying that the velocity of the path is XR dot. In other words, the jump is XR dot delta. So I can rewrite XR plus 1 minus XR as XR dot delta. And putting all that together, we just have a single integral over PR. This thing now depends on PR and XR dot. PR squared V of XR. We've got yet another Gaussian integral in the variable PR this time. PR squared, fine. We have a linear term, fine. We have a constant term. So again, we can use our Gaussian tricks for any integral of this form. And we end up with this expression. Some interesting factor, m over delta to the half, e to the I delta over h bar. And you'll notice something that was beginning to look like a kinetic energy term minus a potential energy term. And indeed, if we put together the whole expression for k, it's a product of lots of things of this form. So we get this factor n times, integrate over lots of different xi's, and products of this exponential. So e to the I delta over h bar, sum of things that look like kinetic energy minus potential energy for each point xr. So that's suggestive. What happens to it in the limit in which n tends to infinity? This sum tends to integral. We get the integral over a dummy time variable along the path, half m xr dot squared. We really do now have the kinetic energy at each point on the path, minus v of xr, the potential energy at the point xr. In other words, we have the Lagrangian, L of x, x dot, tau, integrated from 0 to t, from the start to the finish of this thing. What's that integral? It's the action. So we're going to define this thing as the action functional for a time-dependent path, x of tau. And our, at least the intuition is that we've replaced our sum over piecewise linear paths with a sum over all paths that are taking us from 0 to x, moving through time.
Maybe other questions?
Yeah.
If you go to this continuous limit, wouldn't that already have the paths going back?
Nothing in...
Because there was nothing specific for paths going forwards when you take the limit. If you included the paths going backwards, then I think it would be the same.
Let me think about this.
Our wave function describes only a line.
Yeah. So we've suppressed one of the coordinates. I'm assuming something like a constant velocity in this direction, and we're interested in the paths over x. Was there another question?
Well, in the picture that was before with the lattice, uh-huh. That was just time and space. There was going backwards, which would mean that it that would correspond to going backwards in one of the dimensions in the double slit.
I'm not sure I follow the question. So let me skip back to the slide. This one? Yep.
Yeah, so,
what's that? Coming back. Okay.
In the upward particle path, when the path goes down, that corresponds to going backwards in space. So that would be like it dips into the slit and then it goes back and then changes its mind.
So I really should. Draw this with two space directions, I guess. I kind of have, yeah. I'm assuming that it's moving steadily in the y direction through time, and we're just looking at the x evolution. So, it's supposed to be. It's hard. How to represent two space and one time dimensions on it.
Y and time being the same. Just you assume that y and time coincide.
Mm-hmm.
So you can say that time y is the same thing.
I guess so.
With different spacing, perhaps.
As you when only go backwards in space on the time.
Yeah, but
the time is, so time is going to the right. Yeah, how to say this? I mean, throughout our discussions, the double slit experiment, we've really had at least two space directions in mind, but we've been focusing on one of them. We've been focusing on which slit it went through, and that's a sort of question about the x motion. But of course, it's actually propagating from the source towards a slit, and that's an orthogonal direction to the one we've been focusing on. For the purposes of this discussion, I guess you're right. The right way to say to interpret this diagram is that y and time are effectively identified. The y coordinate is proportional to the time coordinate. Now, sorry, let me move back. So we're going to define, for this particular setup, this particular problem, we're going to define integration over paths by this limiting process. And if that seems like a bit of a hand wave, I think it's fair to say it is a bit of a hand wave, but we're going to do it anyway. So we're going to write down in a sort of suggestive notation, as though we have some general way of understanding path integrals, an integral over, with a capital curly D, all paths x of tau. And when we write that down, we're going to interpret it as the limit as n tends to infinity, this particular normalization factor, this set of integrals. So we arrive slightly sort of suppressing murkiness in the notation, an expression for the propagator as an integral over all paths, e to the I over h bar, action for each particular path. I'm going to give some health warnings. But let's, before we get into things to worry about, let's at least accept some possible virtues of this way of thinking about things. It's a different way of thinking about quantum theory, and it's a way that's suggestive of generalizations to quantum field theory and maybe even to quantum gravity. But let's notice what we haven't done. We haven't done anything that gives us a probability distribution over the paths. Every path has an amplitude, which is given by e to the I over h bar times some action s. Each of those has a modulus 1. So think of some large, massive object. Here's the classical path from point A to point B on the bottom. Here's some very complicated wiggly path on the top. They both have the same mod squared of the amplitude. We can't interpret this calculation as telling us that nature is saying the particle really follows one randomly chosen path. In a way, that's regrettable. I mean, it would be a natural interpretation and quite an appealing one if we did define a probability distribution, but we don't. We've got a way of calculating amplitudes, but no sample space of paths and probability distribution over the paths that makes any sense associated with that. Let's notice something else. The action depends on x, and it depends on x dot, but it doesn't depend on anything higher than that. So if we're interested in what happens at the point B, we need to follow the path up to here, and we need to look at the slope. And if we then become interested in what happens beyond B towards C, well, we can work that out from the coordinates of the path and the slope there. And if we're interested in the total amplitude from A to C, we can simply decompose it into a product. E to the ISAC is just E to the ISB, E to the ISBC. So, and if one thinks about it for a second, we really have a natural algebra structure on path segments. If you want to multiply two path segments together, path segments at least that have points in common, you just need to compose them into the extended path. And we also have a natural notion of addition. The amplitude for some of the paths is given by the sum of the amplitudes of the path. So we're seeing some. Yes? We're not telling some story about where the particle is actually going. We're telling a story about how we associate amplitudes with paths that contribute to the path integral. So if our end goal is to calculate the amplitude for a path that goes from A through B to C, some particular specified path, we can work that out by calculating the amplitude for this bit and then multiplying by the amplitude for this bit. If we want the total amplitude for going from A to C, then, as you say, we'd have to look at all possible intermediate points and sum over them. So we're seeing hints here of some potential and potentially beautiful connection that links algebra with geometry, geometry with physics, physics with algebra. A natural map from the algebra of paths to the complex numbers given by the amplitude map. My health warning should come with health warnings themselves, but let me explain what I mean by that. So let's now think about classical mechanics and quantum theory and the relation between those in the path integral way of describing quantum theory. Suppose we've got some object that we think it's appropriate to treat classically, some large massive thing. Well, we already have a story in classical mechanics about the action functional. It tells us that if the thing goes from A to B, then we can determine which path it will follow once we know the action functional. It will follow the path for which the action is stationary. Usually, in fact, the action is minimal. So if this is the classical trajectory, x classical of tau, and this is any other trajectory, we expect, in general, this inequality to hold. Action for the other trajectory is larger than the action for the classical trajectory. There's some sense in which, there's some quite strong sense, I guess, in which it doesn't really matter what the values of the action functional are for anything else. All that matters is they're not minimal. Classical physics doesn't use the actual values. Quantum theory gives, physical meaning maybe is too strong, but it certainly gives us at least a calculational role to every possible path from A to B and to the value of S for each of those parts. It tells us that you need to know the numerical values of those actions in order to calculate the full amplitude, because you need to sum over all the parts in order to calculate the full amplitude. And let's think about this further. We have a factor 1 over h bar here. So the classical action for a classical object in units of h bar is an enormous thing for pretty much any path. If we change a typical path, even slightly, we'll change this value by something that's large compared to h bar. And so we'll change the phase rather unpredictably. Even for very small variation of the path, we'll find a very large variation in the phase. So what we expect in general, if we take a general path from A to B, and then look at nearby paths, and sum over contributions from lots of nearby paths, is that they look like quasi-random sums of phases. We get a wild oscillation in the phase for small variations of the path. And the net effect of that is you get phases all over the place. They interfere destructively. They cancel. On the other hand, if we look at the specific case of the classical path, there's something slightly different to be said about that discussion. We still vary S, it's true, when we vary the path. But the classical path is a stationary point of the action. Nearby paths, sufficiently nearby paths, have essentially the same value of S, because we need to, the change in S is second order in the change of whatever's parameterizing the path. And so they have essentially the same phase, e to the is over h bar. And so at least sufficiently nearby, they interfere constructively rather than destructively. They all reinforce each other. The phases point in the same direction. So let me confess, that's, although a standard argument, that's, I would not say a rigorous argument. There's sort of hand-waving going on in there. But it's an important intuition that indeed seems to work out in real calculations. And it's telling us that when we deal with classical objects, and if we nonetheless want to look at a quantum propagator, the propagator is effectively determined by sums of amplitudes of paths very close to the classical trajectory. These interfere constructively, and they contribute to the propagator. Everything away from here interferes destructively, cancels out, and so gives essentially no contribution to the propagator. I think it's necessary to be very, very careful about what that argument does and doesn't entail. Uh, First, let's say again, it was hand waving in there. It was not a rigorous argument, but suppose for the moment that we can nonetheless just justify the calculational import of what we just said. Suppose we could find, at least in particular examples, a fully rigorous way of phrasing it. This does not tell us that we can derive what classical mechanics predicts will be the trajectory of the particle. Classical mechanics tells us that going from A to B, the particle will follow the classical path. The rules we've just set out, the path integral formulation of quantum theory, don't give us a way to rigorously justify that statement, even modulo the worries about the rigor of the mathematics. And the reason why I say that is that the rules we set out just don't give us a probability distribution for paths in the first place, as we already discussed. Every path has an equal modulus squared of the amplitude. So we can't possibly start from a... story about amplitudes for paths that applies to every possible path. Here's the classical one. Here's some very non-classical one. We can't suddenly conveniently pretend that this story about amplitudes has been converted into a story about probabilities, even though it may be the case that we could calculate the propagator from A to B as a constructive sum of amplitudes of paths very close to the classical. So. Still, one has to be clear if you're trying to establish a logical derivation of predictions in one theory from predictions in another theory, what the logical statement is about the theory, in this case the path integral approach to quantum theory, what it allows you to say and what it doesn't. We never had a story about probability distributions, therefore we can't possibly derive probabilistic, let alone deterministic, statements about the path of a classical object. And to reinforce that point, I mean, although it's true we can calculate k from the amplitudes of paths very close to the classical trajectory, it's an inconvenient truth, but nonetheless a truth, that we could also calculate k from lots of contributions of paths that just happen to have the same amplitude, not for any particularly good reason, but because the amplitude keeps changing and the phase keeps going. So this is S of x classical over h bar, and this one is S of x classical over h bar plus 2 pi. This is x classical over h bar plus 4 pi, and so on. We could find all sorts of pathological collections of paths. Whose amplitude sum gives the classical propagator. Now, we're not motivated to do that. Nobody really wants to think about these pathological collections of paths. And we are kind of motivated to look at this collection of paths because it's very appealing to say that we've got a direct derivation of classical mechanics from path integral quantum quantum physics. We know the answer we'd really like to get, and we sort of see, a very intriguing mathematical fact that looks, if only we could sort of twist things around in the right way, as though it might justify the answer. But logically, I'm afraid it does not justify that answer. What we do have is a very interesting and very suggestive check on our intuition. Intuition sort of tells us, or at least is happy with the idea, that if we're thinking about a classical object in a quantum calculation, we can ignore all the exotic paths, the ones that are far away from the classical trajectory. That intuition turns out to be right. But it's a logical jump, and I think an unbridgeable logical jump, to go from that to the claim that we have a fully satisfactory and rigorous derivation of classical physics from quantum theory expressed in this formalism. That remains a problem, and I would say remains a very difficult and subtle problem. How are we doing for time? Do we have any? About 5 minutes over. Maybe that's a good place to stop for today in that case. Are there any questions on this? Yeah. So your question is, what is our precise definition of path? Does it include a notion of velocity? Well, wait. For any individual path, the amplitude is e to the I s. Which isn't close to zero. It's some complex number. Its modulus is one. Yeah. A path that's far away from the classical path, yeah. But it still has an amplitude whose modulus is one. Yeah. It's not close to zero. Not close to for any individual path. If you integrate over the nearby paths, at least at the sort of we accept the intuition that these things are going to destructively interfere, then indeed you get something close to a zero amplitude.
So, I mean, we have a positive chance to have
classical objects travel at greater than light speed? Is that, that's the sort of question, I guess. Do we have a positive chance for... why? Can you say more about how you see those two statements as connected? What's non-classical trajectories have?
Well, you said the non-classical
trajectories, they have positive chance. Thanks for pressing on this, because it's something I really should try and reinforce. Our whole point has been to calculate an amplitude for getting from A to B. And I need to keep reinforcing, that doesn't give us a probability for any individual path, nor does it necessarily give us a probability for any subset of a whole set of paths. It gives us probability for getting to A to B, because that's modulus squared of the amplitude. But if we look at any little subcollection of the paths, we haven't been able to identify any set of axioms that allows us to associate probabilities with coarse-grained or fine-grained subsets of the paths. You might be tempted to try and find one, but it certainly doesn't follow from anything we've done so far. And
I think what he means is that, I mean, if you have a classical path that doesn't go, say, in the shortest possible, then...
That doesn't follow the minimum action. Yeah. So if you have a classical path that doesn't have minimal action, then... And it's the action for a massless object.
Assuming that.
Yeah.
Perhaps you could find a non-classical path that would go to, from A to B in a shorter time than allowed by the speed of light. I think that's what you meant.
Is that right? I see. Okay, so we're now trying to probe some what the path integral formalism might or might not be telling us about Minkowski causality, about causality. That's a good question, but let's remember at the moment our discussion's been a discussion for the Schrodinger equation. It's been a discussion for a non-relativistic equation. So we don't expect to recover any story about Minkowski causality. We never put the speed of light into this calculation. I will give you a little toy model another time, probably next time, which looks at least in one space and one time dimension at paths in Minkowski space. But really, you're going to have to, a proper discussion of relativistic path integrals is going to have to wait until quantum field theory courses. I'm not going to say much about this course. So it's a great question. Hold on to that question. Keep, underline it and bring it back in the quantum field theory courses when they start talking about path integrals. It could, I guess we, and it's a good question, maybe we'd have to think whether it's countable or uncountable. But of course, we could, if we vary the path sufficiently, by a sufficiently small amount, even for a classical object, we're going to change the phase only very, very slightly, and so we'll still get. So things that are really, really close to this, and really, really close to this, and really, really close to this, will still reinforce. And so I could certainly produce an uncountable set.
Yeah, but what I mean is if you have just a local minimum, so if you're here, uh-huh. varying it slightly will make it like this, whereas if you're here, it goes up and down, so these cancel anyway.
Uh-huh.
Whereas so these are going to cancel with each other, whereas these aren't.
Uh-huh. So the question was.
So you don't have to bother about the 2.5. I mean, that's the same argument that was before that. Only you look at the stationary points. The ones that have +2.5, they're not stationary anymore.
So I guess I'm trying to make a sort of meta point here. It looks as though we have some set of paths that gives us the right amplitude, and it's not a precisely defined set. I mean, we can make this a little bit thinner or a little bit thicker. Can we find other sets of paths that also, when summed up together, give us the right amplitude? This argument says yes, we can. The next point you might want to make is, well, perhaps this is only a countable set, and perhaps we should be interested in uncountable sets that give us the right amplitude. However, I appreciate there is some difference between these two cases, but I don't think countability can be characterizing it, because we can still play this game of varying these things very, very slightly. And though you're right, it has a different effect, because we're here rather than there. Still, if we're close enough to here, the variation is going to be small. And so it's still an uncountable set. Now, your next point might be, well, okay, but it's a set of much smaller measure for essentially this reason. Well, we could try and explore those intuitions, and maybe, who knows, maybe they might lead somewhere. But then we'd have to have an abstract notion of measure and some story about probabilities associated with those measures, and we'd have to go beyond the rules that we've set up so far for the path integral formalism. Question? Yeah. that's yeah, that's that was sort of, I that seems like a intuitively plausible. That's yeah. Yeah, but it seems to me there's. I'm not quite sure what these words mean at this point. It seems to me there's still some extra logical ingredient that's been put in there. What? Classic mechanics, localized meaning what? Meaning. It precisely. But then any. Any path allows that. Yeah. You might try and do that, but that sounds like a new rule being introduced into the game. And I don't mean to forbid new rules, but I just want to make the point that they're not ones that we've got to hand at the moment. More questions? I mean, maybe I can just sum up the discussion. It's a lovely intuition, this idea that we can understand something profound about classical mechanics from the path integral formalism. And it's a very powerfully suggestive one. And one thing it might suggest is ways of refining the formalism or adding a little more structure, one might hope, a little more structure, in order to genuinely derive classical mechanics from quantum mechanics. But I just want to reinforce the logical point that from all we've been able to justify so far, we can justify a calculation of the classical amplitude as basically defined by the classical path and paths close to it, the amplitude for the classical thing to go from A to B. But we can't justify the statement that it follows that path, because we can't justify any statement that objects follow some particular path. Maybe I should leave the discussion there for now, and I'm sure there will be more questions, and we can maybe continue exploring it next time.